Zehin, please.
Thank you very much, Professor Harber. Thank you to the organizers. Yes, I would like to tell you about this new frontier for biology, which is understanding ourselves through understanding the human brain. And putting together, I would say, many disciplines which involve primarily psychology, cognitive neuroscience, cognitive neuroimaging, and fundamental neuroscience together with physics and with modeling. This is the place where I work in France. It's one of several institutes on the planet that have these new tools to look at the human brain and typically using a panoply of brain imaging methods combined with psychology. Functional MRI is one of the fundamental tools, but also electroencephalography and magnetoencephalography, and I will show you in these talks other techniques are appearing as well. It's impossible to be exhaustive about this field. The meeting of neuroscience ended just yesterday, and it's 42,000 scientists working in neuroscience together in this society. Many more, of course, not belonging to the society. So it's an enormous field. Let me just illustrate some of the power of this field and where it is going. First thing is we can now describe the brain anatomy in increasing detail, thanks to magnetic resonance imaging. This is one image, for instance, of the connections of the human brain, which are accessible now, thanks to the invention from physics of the ability to look at diffusion of molecules by magnetic resonance. The resolution of these techniques is increasing, allowing us to describe a single human brain, living, this is a living person, in all of its details, in ways that are in many ways better than any of the previous atlases by post-mortem. But post-mortem analysis is also catching up, and these are new images that are coming from Jülich in Germany, where images of down to 100 microns are being generated. As you can see, it is now being possible to look at the connectome, the connectivity of the human brain, in extreme detail, and it will soon be the case that we have at least a coarse map of the complete connectivity of some brains, a project a little bit similar to the description, of course, of the genome. But, of course, I think many of you know that magnetic resonance imaging is not delimited to the anatomy of the brain, and its main advantage is to be able to monitor the oxygenation of the blood and therefore indirectly the state of activity of the brain. This is why it's called functional. It is looking at the way the brain is activated during any cognitive tasks. And therefore, the current impetus is largely on describing how specific cognitive functions activate different parts of the brain to make a complete map of the cortex. This is just one example to show you that it is possible now to dissect the brain networks that are involved in spoken language processing. It is becoming so simple that with some of the localizer tools we have now, any of you could be sitting in an MRI, and in 5 minutes, we will get a map, a complete map, of the individual language networks in your brain and how they react to your own mother tongue, but not to other languages you don't know, for instance. Naturally, the genetics revolution is here together with imaging, and so, as was mentioned, it is possible to obtain genomic information, soon the entire genome, from any of the subjects that we are scanning, and so it is possible to cross-correlate the genome with the images of brain activity and to begin to understand the sources of variability in the genome that predict or correlate with variability in brain activation. And this is the case for language networks in this example. There's a very interesting gene called FOXP2, which is involved in articulation and language, and which has a novel mutation specific to the human species, and we can show that variants on this gene modulate, to some extent, the degree of activation in normal subjects during language processing. There is a new picture coming up of sources of individual variability in all sorts of domains where talent or lack of talent or disease can be correlated with brain activity and brain organization. fMRI is largely a technique which is precise in space but not in time. But with these other techniques, electro- and magnetoencephalography, the temporal dynamics of the brain can be resolved because now we are monitoring the currents that are occurring inside the brain, and therefore we are monitoring them in essentially real time, milliseconds or less. We can make maps of this activity. And this results in the sort of movie I want to show you now from MIT, where people were flashed a word, and you can see this is the left hemisphere of the brain. It's been unfolded a little bit, so you can see inside all of the folds. And what you see now is the unfolding of activity at the scale of milliseconds while you are reading a word. So the networks of reading are being described here, starting from the visual cortex, going into the ventral part of the brain, and going into the left hemisphere, and supporting somehow the process of understanding the word and being able to pronounce it. We're still dissecting these networks, but a lot of progress has been made, and some of it is made by the fact that, yes, we can also scan young children. It is not a problem these days to scan 4 years old, 5 years old, before and after they've learned to read. And it is even possible to scan babies and to begin to understand this extraordinary little machine that we all love, which is capable of learning at an extremely fast rate, essentially a superb learning machine. So descriptions of the baby brain are, I would say, one of the terra incognitas of our field, because there are lots of experiments on adults, but not mainly on babies. Yet, as you can see, all the techniques are available. We can see the developing brain. We can even make images of premature infants and growingly now in utero imaging, including MRI. And you can see that the folds of the brain can therefore be described. It's a purely anatomical process. I think I have a movie of that, yes. So you can see interpolation of the growing process of the brain as well as the folding process. Models are being described now to try to understand this as the formation, perhaps, of Turing patterns on the surface of the cortex. So, very interesting interaction between physicists, mathematicians, and neuroscientists. But functional patterns can be described in the baby's brain as well. It is possible to see these language networks that I was showing you earlier in the baby's brain, and there are remarkable discoveries in understanding the degree of organization that we start with. We used to think that the baby's brain was disorganized. It is not the case. It has a sharp organization, a sharp architecture. What you can see here is that a baby listening to his mother's voice or to his mother's language already activates brain networks that are very similar to the adult brain, including in their temporal order and sequence. The information is channeled through specific brain circuits. And of course, the anatomy that corresponds to this network is being described. It is possible to track the fiber networks that are connected different regions of the left hemisphere in this case. And what is extremely interesting, of course, is to acquire this information in the baby, in the child, in the adult, but also in non-human species. Through comparative imaging of non-human versus human species, we can begin to try to understand what is the origin of language, for instance, what is the origin of specifically human abilities. And for instance, it has been claimed that this fasciculus, the arcuate fasciculus, is much less developed in non-human species, for instance, the macaque monkey. Naturally, what is the most interesting, I think, to us is to try to understand how this brain is being changed, and one of the main medium of change in the human brain is education. It is now becoming possible to image either in children before or after education, or also in adults with or without education, the process of change. And this is just showing you an image that we have obtained recently in the lab of what happens when you compare the brains of people who have gone to school and became literate with people who have never had the chance to go to school and are still illiterate. And we can map the changes in literacy and see that there is in particular one area which we've called the visual word form area, which is here in the left hemisphere, in the ventral part of the visual system, it's here too. And you can see that its degree of activation correlates or is predictive of the degree of reading, the fluency with which people can read. And we can see this area change even in individual people as they learn to read. If you lesion this area, you will lose the ability to read. So it is a very causal relationship that you have between the ability to identify written words and the relation and the activation of this area. So the ability to look at the transforming of the brain is interesting, but I think the deepest aspect is the ability to understand down to the level of neural models what is the process. On the left, what you see here is the model of face recognition, already several years old, which is routinely used to recognize faces in a computer based on principles of neural science. Neural science is now guiding the development of models of visual recognition, which begin to be just as good as the real brain. And we might think of similar models for reading, for instance. So artificial systems are being developed, artificial algorithms that try to mimic or capture some of the most essential aspects of brain function. Literacy does not just change the visual system. What we found in this study was that literacy also changed the spoken language system. This was more of a surprise, so we have many surprises like this. It is the case that for all of you in this room who have learned to read, your auditory system for spoken language processing has been amplified by learning to read. And I wanted to show this slide also because this system was studied in a recent study here, which shows you a new technique which is emerging, and I think which play a very important role. In this study, a little array of electrodes was placed over the left hemisphere. This is, of course, not done in normal people. This is done in epilepsy patients, but it is done in laboratories throughout the world to explore the patterns of epilepsy and to help the patient by targeting what is the region at the source of epilepsy. But these sort of data provide also extraordinarily rich evidence for brain function outside of the epilepsy fits. And in this case, by recording over this little region, it was possible to show that there is a neural code for the phonemes that people hear, so that if a person hears a certain phoneme, ba, da, ga, and you monitor the electrical signals from this area, you can now decode from the brain signals what was the phoneme that was being heard by the person. So there is a neural code, and if we understand the neural code, we can decode it. Decoding is appearing with these intracranial recordings. Decoding is also appearing with fMRI. So even from the patterns of brain activation recorded completely non-invasively, it begins to be possible to infer some things about, let's say, basic understanding or coding of speech in the human brain. And these techniques of recording directly inside the brain are extremely interesting for the scientists because increasingly now they are becoming to the level of the single neuron. So some of these electrodes are appropriate to record from single neuron spiking units. And at the single neuron, this is where the code ultimately will be. And for many of these functions, I'm sure you understand, when it comes to language, for instance, we have to study it in the human species and not only, of course, in animals. So we begin to understand all of these changes that are induced by reading. It's just my example function today. And I should say also that the impact of this science will be on the field of education. There is a very interesting interaction which is going on now between education sciences and brain sciences in order to see if this sort of data can improve the teaching, for instance, the teaching of reading in schools. What we begin to understand is that, yes, there are reasons to believe that certain methods of teaching can help the children, and especially an understanding of dyslexia, impairments of reading, can provide better rehabilitation methods. I want to finish with two more challenges, if I have time. One, I think, is a very important philosophical challenge. You can see that this field is touching on what used to be questions of philosophy. One of these questions, of course, is what is consciousness? Why are we conscious of the outside world? How does it work? The famous mind-body problem. We believe the mind is a factor of the brain, but how does it work? So I just want to mention extremely briefly that this is a field of active investigation because it is possible in many ways now to investigate non-conscious versus conscious brains. And one way, which I illustrate here, is to use subliminal images where you can flash a word and it can be made invisible by being surrounded by other shapes. If you were a subject in this experiment, you wouldn't see the word radio. But the word radio is entering your brain, it is processed non-consciously, and we can make it reappear consciously and describe the difference. And of course, there are many other means, patients, anesthesia, many others. So this is just a movie to show you on the top what is happening to a word which is entering your brain and which is not conscious, and in the middle, a word which is entering your brain and which is conscious. And I hope this movie will play. You will see that the word enter into the occipital cortex, and at that time it is completely non-conscious. Here it comes. And you see very clear similar activation for conscious and unconscious. It will progress forward. You see that for a long time there can be non-conscious activity in the brain. And what we are discovering is the power of the non-conscious brain. We are not aware of it, of course, by definition, but a lot of our intelligence, our activities, are determined by non-conscious processes. But what we see afterwards is there is a huge amplification of activity which occurs in the conscious case. You see that the prefrontal cortex here in the front of the brain is very much active under conscious conditions, and we believe that this has to do with becoming aware of a world, becoming aware of the stimulus. There are many such data now being gathered throughout the world. The last advance I want to mention is, and maybe this is an important remark for the philosophy of this, is what is the purpose of all this imaging? Many of you think it is about making maps of the brain, but making maps is just one aspect of what we are doing, and I don't think it's the most important aspect. So it is the more phrenological aspect. What I think it's about is really reading about our mental representations, and this is why cognitive psychology is talking to cognitive neuroscience. We are, through this imaging, in the process of decoding how mental representations operate. And I will just finish with one example. We have discovered several years ago and studied areas that are concerned with calculation and number processing. These areas, again, are located in the same location in all of you, and they will activate whenever you do a little subtraction, for instance. Thanks to comparative research in a monkey, Andreas Nieder and Earl Miller, then at MIT, were able to record from a similar area in the monkey and to make this extraordinary discovery that there are neurons that care about number. So we begin to understand the neuron code here. There are, when you see three objects, for instance, and when you think of the number three, or you see the Arabic digit three, there are neurons that fire maximally for this particular value of the number. And I wanted to finish with this. We can begin to revert the process and train a computer from images of brain activity to determine what was the number that the person has seen. It is not very advanced. It is not complete mind reading. All we can say is that it is better than chance. But being better than chance means that we have captured something about a mental representation at the brain level. So, of course, I could only give you a few examples, but you can imagine that for any mental function of interest, this is occurring now. In particular, there is a very interesting aspect of research concerning the social brain, understanding the social representations that we share with others. I just want to finish by mentioning that there are very important projects from the community that are appearing. And this will be my last slide. One of them, which is appearing in Europe at the moment and which will be presented to the European Commission in a few months, is called the Human Brain Project. And this is an important effort, a little bit similar to the virtual liver that was presented earlier, to begin to gather together all of the data and create a sort of virtual brain, a multi-scale simulation that will be able to mimic and at a certain point maybe to replace some of these experiments with an actual simulation, and therefore to put together all the understanding of the brain. It might include, for instance, a sort of Google map of the brain. We would put together all of the data. In the declaration that we have, it is mentioned that we should try to avoid redundancy in experiments, and there is a lot of redundancy in the science which is being done by competitive means throughout the world. This would be a way to put together the existing data so it can serve as a reference and scientists don't have to redo many experiments over and over again. But beyond all, it is a simulation project. So if we can simulate, it means that we have captured something important about reality in our theories. And as you can see, the field that I am talking about is an extraordinarily multidisciplinary field. It is perhaps the most multidisciplinary. We routinely talk from the molecular biologist to the philosopher. So there is a massive challenge in trying to put this sort of data together to communicate with each other properly in different fields. Well, thank you very much for your attention.